when a human says something. There's all these kind of like hidden assumptions. If I tell my robot to like go get me coffee, if the only thing the robot wants to do was to get coffee, hypothetically, it wants to do get the coffee as quickly as possible. So run through the wall, run over my cat, throw grandma out of the way to get to the coffee machine as fast as possible. And then if I run up, no, bad robot, and I try to shut it off, what will happen? The robot will stop me from hitting the off button. Not because it's like conscious or it has a will to live. No, it will simply be because the robot wants to get me coffee. And if it's shut off, it can't get me coffee. It will resist. It will actively fight me to get me coffee, which is, of course, silly.
Welcome to Deep Dive AI, a podcast from the Open Source Initiative. We'll be exploring how artificial intelligence impacts free and open source software, from developers to businesses to the rest of us. Deep Dive AI is supported by our sponsor, GitHub. Open source AI frameworks and models will drive transformational impact into the next era of software, evolving every industry, democratizing knowledge, and lowering barriers to becoming a developer. As this evolution continues, GitHub is excited to engage and support OSI's deep dive into AI and open source and welcomes everyone to contribute to the conversation.
No sponsor had any right or opportunity to approve or disapprove the content of this podcast.
Welcome, Connor Leahy. Thanks for taking the time. Connor is one of the founders of Eleuther AI, a collective group of researchers of artificial intelligence. He's also founder and CEO of Conjecture, a startup that is doing some interesting research on safety of AI. So we'll talk more about this. Welcome, Connor.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start by explaining a little bit the history of Eleuther AI. How did it came to be and how did you come up with this idea?
So the true story of how Eleuther AI came about. During the pandemic back in 2020, so everyone's bored to tears, stuck at home. And I was hanging out on an ML Discord server, it's like a chat server. And there was some paper that got published talking about like GPT-3 models, like big model training or whatever. And I basically said like, hey guys, wouldn't it be fun to do this? And then someone else replied, this but unironically. And the rest was history. So it very much started as just like a fun hobby project of just like some bored hackers, you know, that were just hanging around looking for something fun to do. So at the time, the GPT-3 model was becoming well-known. The paper was actually published a bit earlier, but now the API was now becoming accessible to some people. So people were noticing this is really cool. We could do all these great things with it. And what was very interesting with GPT-3 as a very specific kind of AI model was that it was just unprecedentedly large. It was like, you know, had this huge supercomputer to build this model. And so that was like a very interesting technical challenge. And it was also very interesting, and the model, the final model, GPT-3, was really interesting for a lot of reasons. But basically, it started as kind of more of a joke, just kind of like, you know, we're bored, let's just mess around. We don't have big supercomputers, so we didn't expect to get very far. But yeah, things went a lot further than expected. We started to get more and more interest and also resources. We started to like together some models and stuff. And yeah, very pretty quickly, we started taking this more seriously, and we thought, thinking more seriously about what do we actually want to do? Is this actually a good thing to do, et cetera, et cetera.
So you basically put together a band of hackers and programmers, researchers from different places all around the idea of creating an alternative to OpenAI's models?
That's not how I would describe it. No. So the name is very much tongue-in-cheek. Of course, we were all sad that we didn't have access to GPT-3 because GPT is cool. But the goal was never to, it's like OpenAI is a big for-profit company with billions of dollars of research money and like computers and whatever. The goal of Eleuther AI very much was always to be a group of independent researchers doing interesting work and hopefully useful work for the world. And in particular, one of the reasons we thought this work was very promising is me and many other people at Eleuther AI think that artificial intelligence is the most important technology of our time. And as it becomes more and more powerful and, you know, it can do more and more tasks, it will become a more and more powerful and dominant force in our society. And it's very important to understand this technology. And that's, you know, one of the reasons I now, you know, have a startup where we work on researching safety of AI systems, how to make them more reliable, how to make them safer, how to and make them not do things we don't want them to do, which is a big problem with AI and only will become more of a big problem. So with Luther AI, what we saw basically was an arbitrage opportunity. We saw that there is a lot of cool research to be done with large models, and also important research trying to understand these models. How do they work internally? How do they fail? And so on. There's a lot of these opportunities, but building an actual model like this is extremely expensive and technically difficult. You need very specific kinds of engineering skill sets, and it's very, very expensive.
Right.
But once you have built such a model, using it for experience is much, much cheaper, like magnitudes of order. So we saw this opportunity that we could pay this one-time cost in order to make this kind of technology more accessible for like academic researchers, safety researchers, people with less resources that might be able to do valuable research with this kind of artifact.
Help me understand a little bit better what's going on. So you have, there's always this myth that only the very large corporations or research institutes like, I don't know, NASA, CERN can have the processing power and the money and the data and the knowledge to train these large models. You started from a large model, right? How did you get the first model built? And then how do you progress?
It's kind of like three main things that go into building a large model, which is data, engineering, and compute. And depending on what kind of model you're building, data may or may not be a bottleneck. For the kinds of models we were building, kind of language models, data really isn't much of a bottleneck. So like it's still a pain to get the data together and whatnot. And this is why we pulled together our data set, which we called the pile, and we then also released. But it's not really a bottleneck. The engineering can be a bottleneck in the sense that it's not trivial, especially back then. Nowadays, there is more open source libraries and such that make this kind of training of large models easier.
Wait, when you say back then?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. Okay, we're not talking 30 years ago.
No, I'm not talking 30, I'm like 2 years ago. This was very difficult. Even 1 year ago, this was still more difficult than it is today.
And what changed?
Companies like NVIDIA and Microsoft released a lot of their code. Mm. So with libraries such as DeepSpeed and Megatron that make this kind of stuff easier. It's still not easy. Also, like Facebook released the FSDP library in Fairsec, which helps like training large models. It's still not at all easy. The engineering is less hard than it was at the time. It was less like, at the time, you know, there was like a few dozen people in the world who really knew how to make these, and they existed only in these large corporations. I think that's still the case, that there's, you know, maybe a few hundred people who really have experience building large models hands-on, and have like, you know, like a lot of ML is kind of like alchemy. It's like dark magic.
Right.
You have to know all the secret tricks to make things work. It's getting better, but it's still quite tricky. The third component that goes into these kinds of models, compute, is actually the biggest bottleneck. The amount of computation that goes into building something like GPT-3 is massive. And it's not like you can just, you know, run this on your CPU or something. You need massive clusters of GPUs, all interconnected with, you know, high-end supercomputing grade hardware. Like, you know, you can't do this on like standard hardware. You need like the supercomputer grade stuff, which is very expensive and quite tricky to use sometimes. The Luther AI, we had several, I'd say, phases. The first phase, we got our compute from what is called the TPU Research Cloud, which is a project from Google to give academic access to some of their TPU chips, which are specific, you know, chips for training ML models. And they were quite generous with us, with giving us access to pretty large amounts of these chips for doing our research. So our first models that we released, GPT Neo models, were trained on this, including on also GPT-J, which was a later model that was also done by Ben Wang, who was a Luther AI contributor at the time. We then later started working with a cloud company named CoreWeave, who are a specialized GPU provider. And we kind of basically kind of had like a deal that was like, you know, we'll help them test their hardware, kind of like debug things and stuff. Mm-hmm. And in return, they'll let us train our models on some of the hardware they were building. So that resulted in the GPT Neo X model, which is the largest model we've released at this time. We have some potential new partnerships going on in the background right now. We'll see if anything comes of that or not.
If I understand correctly, you're saying that the engineering pieces are becoming more simpler, commoditized almost because of the releases of the big companies that are releasing code. Data, you mentioned, is not that much of an issue. It's hard, but we're talking text, right, in these,
yeah,
for these models. So yeah, we don't get into the multiple petabytes of storage necessary.
Yeah.
Right. And then the third is the the hardware pieces. So from the tech's perspective, the data that goes into the model, the training, how do you acquire it? What kind of volumes are we talking about? Where do you get the data to start from?
So for text data in particular, I'm not too familiar with other modalities. You need truly stupendous amounts of text. Rule of thumb is you want a terabyte of raw text, which is a truly unimaginably large amount of text. That is billions and billions.
Compressed or uncompressed?
This is uncompressed. So a terabyte of uncompressed text is kind of what you want to aim for or something. So I think the pile is uncompressed about 800 gigabytes of text, which is enough.
So the pile is the starting point, the data, the raw data.
That is the data set that we built for training our models and we released. So if you need to get 800 gigabytes of text of various sorts, that's a place you can get it quite easily. So the way we built the pile was a lot of it comes from Common Crawl, which is a huge dump of internet sites. I forgot who made it, but it's massive petabytes of scraped websites and stuff that we then post-process. We try to filter out spam and then filter out the text from the HTML and stuff like that. Then the other part is a massive amount of curated data sets. So we took lots of data sets that existed. For example, we took data sets, patents that are from various chat rooms or whatever. I don't remember everything's in there. There's a lot of medical text, it's PubMed. There's a large amount of publicly available scientific documents, papers in the biomedicine. And also we took from Archive, which is this pre-publication server, which has a huge amount of, physics, math, computer science papers. We scraped all of that, converted all that into text. So the pile, compared to other data sets, is weighted more heavily towards scientific, technical data, less on the social media chats. There's some of that too, but it's much less. It's not focused on that. A lot of it is very technical documents and such.
Right. You didn't take Wikipedia or material books.
Oh, no, Wikipedia's in there too.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah. There's all kinds of stuff. You can read the paper, which is I think 40 data sets, 20 or 40 data sets are in there from all kinds of sources. Wikipedia, I think in total is a few gigabytes maybe of text, maybe 4 or something. So you need a lot.
Right. So and you store it somewhere on the cloud, that's not a big deal for now.
Funny story about that. So it is currently hosted by BI, which is a kind of a pirate kind of data hosting service. So there's literally a guy called The Archivist. Don't know what his real name is. He's completely anonymous. I think he might be an international fugitive. I don't know. And he's just whenever we need to host something, we just tell him. And he's yeah, no problem. Just host it for us. So that's how we host our data sets, at least in our models, because he just has infinite storage. So it's a fun hacker story.
Sort of underlying the nature of the group. You have now the pile, you have the trained model, you have the hardware. Of course, you got the competence and to do all of this. And you have created a bunch of models that are somewhat replicating or play fields and alternatives in to some extent to OpenAI. You're doing a completely different approach compared to them, though. They're not releasing their models. They are keeping them behind an API for safety reasons, or at least that's the story. So why are you releasing it? Are you not afraid?
So that is a very good question. And the answer is, of course. Of course, you should be concerned when you build a new technology that has unprecedented capabilities and you use it either even as an API or you deploy it or you make it public. All these things are things that should be considered. So I think there is this meme that sometimes exists inside the scientific community that as a scientist, you're you have no obligations to the downstream effect of your work. I think that's obviously bullshit. In my heart, I'm just I just want to do science all the time, just build all the things and who cares, it's fine. Let the politicians sort out how to use it.
Right.
That's just not how the world works. And it's not a good way to think about this. So there's sometimes this belief that people think Luther AI's stance is all things should be public all the time, always. That is not our stance and has never been our stance. But I understand why people are confused about this. There are also several other groups that are vaguely associated with us, that is their opinion. I strongly disagree with them. So it's always been the case with Luther AI that we think there are some specific things in this specific instance, which we think it is net positive for these specific reasons to be released. So I think in the specific instance of a specific thing that's going on right now, it is more net positive for these models of various language models of various sizes to be accessible for researchers to do certain types of research than it would be not to be. But we've said from the very beginning, if I, for example, had access to a quadrillion parameter model or something that's like completely unprecedented, we would not release it. Mm. And because who knows what that thing can do? It does not seem like a good idea to just jump something that no one knows. So there's a very specific argument that we believe 99% of the damage done by GPT-3 was done the moment the paper was published. As the saying goes, the only secret about the atomic bomb was that it was possible. And then people are like, well, what if Russian disinformation agents use it? And I'm like, the paper's out there. If a few hackers in a cave can build these kinds of models, you think the Russian government can't? Of course they can. You know, of course they can just buy a supercomputer and train this stuff. I think there are downstream effects of Eleuther AI that may not have been a good idea. But the way I see things, and people disagree with me about this here, is I think very powerful AI is coming very, very soon. Human-level AI is coming quite soon. Mm. And I expect it, for various technical reasons, to have many properties in common with the models we're seeing today. I don't expect a full shift. I very much disagree with people who say oh, we've made no progress towards human-level AGI. These things aren't intelligent. They won't make any progress. I fully disagree. I think these people are not paying attention or are confused about what these things are actually capable of. So I expect that the studying these technologies that currently exist is very, very important. And as I said, this is arbitrage opportunity. These are the models we release are much smaller and much less capable than GPT-3. So GPT-3 and many other groups have also had models of similar capacity internally and such. Now there's open source models of GPT-3 size anyways, like the OPT models and the Bloom model. So it's always been a very contingent truth, is that we're like, okay, releasing models like this will have some unknown consequences. People might use them for spam. People might use them for something I hadn't even thought about before. Maybe someone will come up with some new use of this model that I would have never thought about that was actually bad. Maybe they'll come up with very positive uses of these models. I don't know. I think reasoning about how new technologies will affect the world is very hard ahead of time. I think there's two conflicting parts inside of me. The one part is that historically speaking, generally, every new technology people are afraid of, but then when it's actually deployed, it's actually good. Mm. And it's and in retrospect, we're I'm glad this technology was. Imagine if people were try to make, electricity illegal. Because people could shock themselves. So we should you should only have a license to have electricity in your home or something like that, right? Obviously that would have sucked.
There was that debate.
This kind of debate did exist. I think we as modern people are quite happy that the optimists won that one. That is a fully legitimate argument. That's not a silly argument to be made. I think that's a good argument to be made. But there's also the other one, which is the argument to be made. Hey, there's some very specific risks we can see that are not hypothetical. And now we can debate about how do these risks measure up to against each other. And for this very specific technology right now of these language models, I think the optimist side, in my opinion, has the somewhat of an upper hand. But that doesn't mean that this applies to all technology. So some people would say, so you like electricity, Connor. Well, what about nukes? Those use electricity, right? You okay with those? I'm like, whoa, slow down. Yes, those do use electricity, but that's a whole different class of thing. So that's what I mean when I say I was never my or Eleuther AI stance that everything always should be released all the time. Because who knows? Maybe tomorrow OpenAI creates some model that has some crazy capability or some really dangerous capability that is super scary and they shouldn't release that. Basically, at some point, someone will create an AI system that is truly dangerous, that is actually dangerous, not just spam or something, but it's truly dangerous. And I don't know what that system's going to look like. I don't know who's going to make it, but it's going to exist. And I think it would be great if it's not impossible for them to not release that. I think it would be great if we kind of can accept that maybe some things we should be careful about.
Right.
Whether or not it applies to this specific situation that we have in front of us today.
And it's probably not easy to imagine, but it could be something that slips out of a lab the same way that the first internet worms were not contained by mistake and ended up creating new carriers for infections inside computers. When we chatted another time, you mentioned scary scenarios of AIs unleashed with a pile of money attached to them to do maximization of shareholders' value.
Yeah, that's like one of the scenarios, for example, I take relatively seriously. What is AI? What does AI do? Generally, the way, like, for example, we have like game playing AI, right? Usually this uses what's called reinforcement learning. And the way this usually works is we have some kind of function, some kind of score, and you kind of train the AI to do whatever actions maximizes this score. You know, get like high score in Pong or whatever, right? So if we kind of like just like straightforwardly extrapolate this, where we're going right now, look at the AI technology that exists today versus like 2 or 3 years ago. Nowadays, we have AIs, they can just like type in a sentence and they'll write you generate a full photorealistic image of anything you can imagine. You have these GPT systems that can write full stories or chat with you like a person, or like the Minerva system recently, which can solve incredibly difficult math problems. Mm. You know, it's like as good as a human or even better. It's like these like incredible sophistication that did not exist 2 or 3 years ago. Now, let's say that just continues. Let's just take the naive attempt. We'll say, okay, things went this fast the last 2 years. Let's just imagine the next 2 years go just as fast or faster.
Right.
And then the next 2 years after that, and the next 2 years after that, and the next 2 years after that. Something has to give. Like, you know, either progress is going to slow down for some reason, or we're going to see some crazy systems really, really soon. Systems that can optimize for very complex goals, that we can, you know, have assistants that we tell them to do a thing, and then they can like log on to the internet and just do those tasks. And now we imagine we have these systems becoming more and more powerful. And now we say we have some really big corporation, you know, Google or OpenAI or whatever, the biggest system of these kinds ever, like something that's so powerful, it's smarter than humans. You know, it runs a million times faster. It's read all books in history. It can do perfect, you know, IMO gold medal of mathematics, et cetera, et cetera. And then you give it some goal like, okay, make maximum profit. Mm. What will such a system do? And I think if you meditate on that question a bit, the obvious things are not always good or even mostly not good. I mean, if you're trying to maximize share price of your company, right? Well, why not just hack the stock exchange? Why not just put a gun to the stock exchange CEO's head and say, you know, increase my price right now? Why not do all kinds of crazy things? Blackmail people or like, you know, manipulate people, like create a huge propaganda campaign.
Right. For humans, we have set norms and laws to prevent that.
And those also don't always work. You know, we have corporations doing illegal and bad things all the time. Well, now let's imagine we have a corporation that's also 1,000 times smarter than any other human. It's better at hacking. It's better at coming up with plans. It's better at propaganda. It can generate images and videos and voices, you know, can impersonate anyone. These are all things that AIs can already do. Like none of this is like real, except like the planning, none of this is really science fiction. We could already imitate voices. We could already, you know, generate arbitrary images. There's already like hacking tools that use AI. There's already, you know, math solving AI and stuff. All this stuff is already real.
Right.
Now we just have to just kind of put the parts together in our head and extrapolate. And then it's pretty clear that this could pretty easily lead to some pretty scary scenarios really quickly.
Absolutely. Yes. But without going even, as you were saying, too far out in the future, there are already cases where we can't really distinguish the actions of a human versus the ones of an AI.
Deep Dive AI is supported by our sponsor, DataStax. DataStax is the real-time data company. With DataStax, any enterprise can mobilize real-time data and quickly build the smart, highly scalable applications required to become a data-driven business and unlock the full potential of AI. With AstraDB and Astra Streaming, DataStax uniquely delivers the power of Apache Cassandra, the world's most scalable database. With the advanced Apache Pulsar streaming technology in an open data stack available on any cloud.
DataStax lives the open source cycle of innovation every day in an emerging AI everywhere future. Learn more at datastax.com.
No sponsor had any right or opportunity to approve or disapprove the content of this podcast.
So now I wanted to go back a little bit to the power of AI and the risks that it poses and talk about the mitigations. What do you think we should be doing as a society to make sure that these systems don't spin out of control, but don't stop the progress? We can't say, don't do AI anymore.
Telling people not to do AI is hopeless. You know, people can't coordinate around stuff like that. It's way too profitable. It's there's this archetype of the scientist where like problem, even if it's bad, it's just too sweet. It has to be solved. There's quite a number of people in the AI community who themselves kind of have admitted at several points in time where they're like, yeah, this might be dangerous, but I can't help myself. It's just too cool. I have to do it. John von Neumann is quite known for having said stuff like that. And several modern AI people I'm not going to name have said similar things in public in the past. So obviously, just like shutting down AI or something is neither feasible nor desirable. AI is also the most powerful technology of our time to improve our lives, to allow us to address tons of problems that we are currently facing. I think a massive amount, maybe even the majority of problems in our society are the bottleneck to solving them is more intelligence. If we could just solve science faster, if we could just develop cures faster, if we could just do all these things faster and more efficiently, we could improve society immeasurably. Imagine if our scientists just worked 100 times faster. That would be insane. We would live in such an incredible world. That would make the world so much better, like more than like almost anything else in the history of mankind, if we could do this. But clearly, as tempting as that is, it is a double-edged sword, is that AI is a tool. It is not good nor evil. It's just a tool. It's just a technology. It is a system that can be both good and bad. And I think abuse is definitely a possibility, but I'm far more concerned about the, accident type scenario. So we have totally well-intentioned people trying to build like an AI scientist or something, and they just aren't careful or just not aware that this could go wrong in some way, and then accidentally build a system that does something totally different. And before they notice that something is wrong, it's already like escaped onto the internet.
And we have Skynet. No, that's a movie.
The government is already and militaries are already eyeing AI everywhere. Think of this as, first, there is a technical solvable problem, which is something called the alignment problem, which is the problem of how do we get an AI system to actually do what we want? This sounds trivial, but it's actually really hard. Because like what a human actually wants isn't like usually what he says. When a human says something, there's all these kind of like hidden assumptions. If I tell my robot to like go get me coffee, if the only thing the robot wants to do was to get coffee, hypothetically, it wants to get the coffee as quickly as possible. So it run through the wall, run over my cat, throw grandma out of the way to get to the coffee machine as fast as possible. And then if I run up, no, bad robot, and I try to shut it off, what will happen? The robot will stop me from hitting the off button. Not because it's like conscious or it has a will to live. No, it will simply be because the robot wants to get me coffee. And if it's shut off, it can't get me coffee. It will resist. It will actively fight me to get me coffee. Which is, of course, silly. Like, of course,
right.
It's silly.
Yeah.
But you can imagine how systems that are deployed in the wild could get this property of like, well, if it's maximizing profit, well, shutting it down will not maximize profit. So it better have a few backup copies running in the cloud so it can't be shut off. And then you have all these kinds of scary scenarios. So what I personally focus on, it's also what I do at Conjecture, is focusing on this technical realm. Okay, how could I even build a system that understands to not do those things, that lets itself be shut off, that understands that when I say get me coffee, I also mean don't run over grandma, that understands that these are what I mean by that, that doesn't do crazy, insane things whenever I ask for normal things. And this is a really hard technical problem, really hard. It sounds easy, but like the deeper you go into it, the more you're like, oh shit, this is like genuinely difficult and like confusing as hell. Because humans are confusing, right?
Right. Yeah.
What all kinds of weird things. Humans are confusing and the world is confusing. And yeah, things are complicated. So if I, like the one thing I would want is like, just have a few more smart people working on this problem. I'm not even saying everyone should work on this. I'm not even saying, everyone should drop everything and work on this. I mean, like a few top professors could consider working on this problem. It's a pretty cool problem. It's like an important problem. It's clearly something that, top AI professors would be perfectly suited to work on. And somehow very few are working on this. It's like a very small number of people working on this problem.
If I understand correctly, you're kind of thinking of the Asimov's law robotics embedded inside AIs.
Unfortunately, the three laws of robotics are selected for making interesting stories, not for actually working.
Absolutely.
Obviously, that it wasn't actually work, but something like that that does work would be great.
Mm-hmm. Something that works that can prevent, if I may try to summarize to see if I understand correctly, you're basically thinking at solving a problem of embedding some safeguards inside the code itself, inside the machines themselves.
Yeah.
So that we can predict and we can expect that if the lever of shutdown is pulled, it actually shuts down.
That's what's known as a stop button problem. If someone would find a solution to the stop button problem, I would be like over the moon. I would be so happy because it's actually genuinely very hard. It's very, very hard to make a robot that is truly indifferent to being shut off. Because usually what happens is either they try to resist being shut down or they become suicidal and instantly shut themselves off. And it's very hard. No one knows how to do this. No one knows how to build a robot that doesn't care, that will let you shut it down, that will not resist you, but also will shut itself down. No one knows how to do this currently, like mathematically. So I don't think that's the whole problem. I think there's like more problems, like inferring human preferences, like all these, like, you know, like unspoken things, like having like kind of conservatism, like avoiding, you know, the robots doing some crazy things or whatever. You know, to be clear, when I say robots, I don't actually expect it to be robots. I'm like artificial systems that are, you know, computer yeah. programs. Just robots is more evocative. And yeah, I think there's a bunch of problems here that we are just like really don't have answers to, but seems like we should be working on. Like the stop button problem is like a clear, pretty clear problem that just like more people should be trying to solve this. Like I think in the whole world, there's maybe like 200 people working on this problem in total,
yeah.
as far as I'm aware, which seems like there should be a few more people take this problem seriously. And if they find out there's a simple solution to it, great, awesome. Then I'm the happiest man alive. Let's go. But currently, the way things look, there's a lot of these problems that we don't have answers for. And that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's probably not as sexy as others.
Yeah, it's much funner to build the bigger system that, you know, solves all the problems and is faster than all the other ones. And you make a lot of money off of it. And you raise a lot of VC money. Of course, it's more fun to build bigger and bigger and bigger things. And I totally get that. Like, I'm guilty of this myself in the past. But ultimately, if the thing doesn't do what you want it to do, that's going to be a problem.
It sounds a little bit like the same problem that computer software has with security. It's always an afterthought because it's net cost rather than something that immediately perceived as bringing value.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. If I had like one message to the wider world who may or may not listen to this, I think one of the biggest things, if I could, like one group of people that I wish would work on this problem, and as far as I could tell, aren't really working this problem, is security hackers. So people working computer security, applying their minds to AI safety. It's a clear fit. It's a, you know, it's a classic security problem. Like, how do we get these systems to behave the way we want them to and not the way we don't want them to? It's a classic security problem. It's a very novel, hard problem. You have to solve all these kind of new challenges here. It seems like a perfect fit for the computer security community. And I would love to see more people from the computer security world trying to tackle this problem.
How, for example, hackers should fix a bug inside a model?
Well, currently, we don't know. So someone should try.
Okay, so...
We're at the point where we have these super complicated systems. You know, a GPT, used in the wild and whatever, and we just have no idea what's going on inside of them. But we have some idea. But like, we don't really, it's not like we can look at the code. That doesn't tell us anything. Like, not really.
Right.
Like, there's all these like weird things happening internally. Like, what is the computation internally doing? It's not possible currently that we say, oh, we see a failure case in our model, and we're like, oh, that's not good. And then we like go into the model and fix it. We can't currently do this. And I don't think this is a fundamental problem. I think if we develop the tools and the technologies, this is a thing we could learn how to do. There's already some very early work in this direction. Like David Bao's lab at MIT, for example, has published a paper not too long ago where they managed to edit memories of language models. So they, for example, made a GPT model believe that the Eiffel Tower is in Rome instead of Paris.
Okay.
Which is incredibly cool. That's incredibly cool. And this is obviously how we should develop tools. Like tools like this, where we can like look at the memories or like edit them, and we can like see how the internals of these models work. That's a lot of what we do at Conjecture. We work on interpretability research. We try to take the inner parts of these networks, decompose them into understandable bits, and then see how can we see where failure modes come from? How can we edit these things? How can we manipulate them? How can we test them for safety features and so on? And this is very early work. So like if you're a young career researcher looking for some like low-hanging fruit that haven't yet been plucked, there is just an orchard. There's a massive orchard of low-hanging fruit in like interpretability and AI safety. Like I have such a huge like list of projects that I wish we could do. I just don't have enough time and I don't have enough engineers to do. So I think this is an incredibly promising.
This is pretty awesome because you're basically leaving us with a positive note by saying that one of the concerns that other speakers, people I talked to have highlighted is how incredibly opaque these systems are. And that once you build the model, you have a hard time unless you retrain, which could be expensive. I don't know if your output from the GPT-3 like is too sarcastic or abuses of commas and does not know how to use punctuation correctly. Like how do you fix it without having to retrain the whole thing, which is, as you were saying, it's expensive. But you're basically saying that there are ways, there's research going into the direction of looking into these artificial synapses connections and tweak them in a way that we can predict the or fix.
Yeah, so there's this meme that's been around in the AI community for quite a while, and neural networks are complete black boxes. It's impossible to understand what's going on in them. And that is just false. That is just not true. I have overwhelming evidence that is just completely false. There is so much structure inside of neural networks. There are so many things you can understand inside of them. That doesn't mean it's easy. This is like a very nascent level of research, but like I was skeptical about this too, like 2 or 3 years ago. But now that I've like actually worked on the problem for a while and I've seen like other people in this field, I'm like, wow, like every time you put the effort into it and you try to take apart and you like look at the different parts, there's so many low hanging fruit. There's so much to be found. And there's so few people working on this problem. And there's really just like a handful of groups in the whole world, like really saying like, nope, we're just going to try. We're going to try to take these things apart. And so I expect over the next couple of years, including, you know, some of the work, hopefully from conjecture, will show the computational primitives and like the internal structure of these things that will allow us to like much more selectively understand what is going inside them. How can we edit these things and such? Will it be perfect? I don't know. Probably not.
Probably not.
But I think there is like a massive amount of promise here that we are just starting to unearth. And I think there's like real reason for optimism there. Will this solve the whole safety problem? Of course not.
Right. It's a step.
It's a really promising step forward. It's like we are conjecture work on this problem quite a lot. We're hoping to be actually publishing one of our results pretty soon, which I'm pretty excited about. We just really tried to look at it and we found all this structure and like all these like pieces that you can understand and you can take apart. And there are some groups out there that really are taking it seriously. And I'm very optimistic that we will understand neural networks as white boxes or way more very soon.
That's great to hear. So what kind of resources do you need in order to understand that problem? Like we were saying that to train, you need a lot of data, the engineering capacity and compute. To investigate inside the neural network, what do you need?
Creativity. You need to be creative because it's a new field of research. Every time you come into a new field of research, you need to be creative. Like you need to come up with new ways of thinking about a problem. And luckily, you need much less resources than to train these models because you can use pre-trained models. So you will need some GPU or something to do some of the research. That's unfortunately just the nature of ML research.
Yeah.
But there's a ton of research you can do by using like Luther AI models, for example. So you don't have to retrain them from scratch. You can just use the fit and you can like study the internal parts and do lots of interesting exploration. Like the one thing you will definitely need is you need to actually learn the math. Like you need to actually know linear algebra and you have to actually look at the internals of the model. In the ML, we've gotten lazy. We've gotten lazy. We let the PyTorch handle all the linear algebra and stuff. And then we lose like a real deep tacit understanding of what's going inside the model. Actually looking inside the models, what do these numbers mean? How do they combine? What's the linear algebra here? This is not like, grad school level math. This is all undergrad level math. But like really understanding what is going on inside a network? Like what is actually going on inside? Being comfortable with, undergrad level linear algebra and stuff like that is, I think, just incredibly undervalued. If you're a postdoc, massive IQ statistician or algebraist, why don't you just take a shot at neural networks? See what the structure is inside of them. If you're a formal systems, PhD, and you have like all this knowledge about like formal languages and computability and whatever, why don't you take a look at a GPT network and see what's the transformers encode internally? What are the complexity properties? All these things I expect to lead to very interesting research.
Wonderful. This is a call for the next generation of geeks out there. Math and linear algebra is what will prevent us from getting into Skynet situation. All right, Connor, thank you.
My one shout out is try your shot at linear algebra, interpretability, understanding neural networks, and shout out to the computer security world out there. Your skills are more required than ever. And I think there is going to be an extremely valuable field. Conjecture is not currently hiring, but hopefully in the near future, we will be hiring. And if you're someone who's very interested in interpretability, safety, and or an experienced computer security expert, you would be someone we might want to talk to. So please feel free to reach out to us, conjecture.dev.
Thanks for listening. And thanks to our sponsor, Google. Remember to subscribe on your podcast player for more episodes. Please review and share. It helps more people find us. Visit deepdive.opensource.org where you find more episodes, learn about these issues, and you can donate to become a member. Members are the only reason we can do this work. If you have any feedback on this episode or on Deep Dive AI in general, please email contact@opensource.org. This podcast was produced by the Open Source Initiative with the help from Nicole Martinelli. Music by Jason Shaw of Audionautix.com under a Creative Commons Attributions 4.0 international license. Links in the episode notes.
Oh, shall. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the speakers and are not the views of their employers, the organizations they are affiliated with, their clients, or their customers. The information provided is not legal advice. No sponsor had any right or opportunity to approve or disapprove the content of this podcast.